Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behaviour in a practical, fun and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well, what tips do they have for you and I, and I quiz them about how they apply their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. This is episode 68. I'm Ellen, and I'm glad you're here. In fact, I'm wondering where you are right now. I often try to imagine where listeners are and what they're doing while listening to the show. I do know that some people listen while they're running or while they're driving, and I know that because you've told me so. I have been told also that you like to listen while you walk the dog, which I think is a lovely way to spend a little bit of your time each week, maybe. Although I suspect the dog expects this every day, perhaps not the listening, but certainly the walking. Osher Ginsberg, if you listen to his podcast, actually asks listeners to tag him in what he calls podsies. So like selfies, but for a podcast. So you take a photo of wherever you are and what you happen to be doing while you're listening to his show and then tag him on Instagram or Instagram stories or wherever you popped it. And it's kind of fun to see where everyone is listening in from. So maybe, just as an idea, and if you're so inclined, take a photo of where you are right now, not while you're driving though, because that's not safe, pop it on social media and tag me in it, usually at Potential Psychology on most of the things, because I'd love to see a little bit of your life while you're listening in, because I'm just sitting here looking at lines on a computer monitor and a microphone, which really isn't very interesting. So tell me where you are while you're listening, because it's bound to be more interesting than this right now. So in other happenings this week, I was speaking to a lovely listener, hello to Carly, who had popped onto the Potential Psychology website to complete a career personality profiler questionnaire, which is a little tool that we have available online, which you can use to explore your career interests and develop some insight into possible career paths if that's where you're at. And anyway, we were doing her debrief and the strength of love of learning came up. And this was actually a strength that we both share. It's one of my top five strengths. It was one of Carly's top strengths. And if you don't know what your top strengths are, or you have absolutely no idea what I'm talking about, I'll pop a link to what's called the VIA Strengths Survey in the show notes for the episode. I know you may be familiar with this because I know lots of our listeners are, but if you haven't, you might like to have a little explore. It is free to complete. But essentially, your psychological strengths are character traits that give you energy when you engage them. So they fuel your intrinsic motivation, they make you feel good, and they contribute to your well-being when you get to use them in your work or in any other of your activities. So Carly and I share this love of learning as a strength, which means that we both enjoy and we're really energized by learning for learning's sake. And we speculated that this may be a strength for a large proportion of our lovely listeners here on the podcast, including you. I know for me, it's a strength that fuels my desire to keep finding and conversing with the vast array of fascinating guests that we have here on the show, because I get to learn from each and every one of them. And it's also one of the reasons behind our partnership for this season of the podcast with the Wellbeing Evidence and Horizons Conference. So the conference is an education event, and the very purpose of which is to inform and enlighten and inspire those of us who have an interest in well-being and performance and resilience and health and happiness and buoyancy, particularly because I think many of us also have an interest in the science behind these topics. So the Wellbeing Evidence and Horizons Conference is a cool event to look forward to in 2020 to indulge your love of learning. I will certainly be indulging mine while I'm there. And I'm super pleased to be collaborating with the team from the event for the season of the show. I'll pop the details in the show notes if you haven't had a chance to check it out. But their website is weh.org.au. Now, while we're indulging our love of learning today, I have a fascinating conversation for you with today's guest. I recently had the joy of reading Tales from the Valley of Death, Reflections from Psychotherapy on the Fear of Death. And I say joy very intentionally because despite the title and the cover image of the book, which is a young woman being embraced by a skeleton, all in black and white, I learned so much from this book. I learned more about psychotherapy and the relationship that a therapist forms with their client. I learned more about obsessive compulsive disorder, which is a disorder that is common throughout the stories told in the book. I learned more about the experiences that shape us to become who we are. I learned about death and the worries that we all hold and what happens when those worries kind of take over. I learned about existential, religious, and cultural responses to worries about death. But most of all, I learned so much about the resilience of individuals facing some of the most difficult fears and circumstances that I can kind of imagine. So I then got to interview Rachel Menzies, our guest for today and co-author of the book, and I learned even more from Rachel. So let's listen in and together indulge our love of learning. With me today is Rachel Menzies. Rachel is a psychologist who currently practices in Newtown in Sydney. She's a researcher, an author, a PhD candidate, an editor, and a speaker with a special interest in death anxiety, including existential issues and their role in driving abnormal behaviour and numerous anxiety and mood disorders. And Rachel is also the co-author, alongside her father, Professor Ross Menzies, of Tales from the Valley of Death, Reflections from Psychotherapy on the Fear of Death, which sounds like a very intense tome, but I have just finished reading it and I loved every minute of it. It was just amazing, fascinating. So welcome, Rachel.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
I have thoroughly enjoyed the book. Rather than me recount what it's all about, can you perhaps tell us a little bit, not only about the book itself and what it contains, but how you and your father came to write it?
Yeah, so the book itself, at the heart of the book really are these 10 interviews with 10 different clients who have struggled with fears of death across their life. So most of the book is really made up of these really interesting 10 cases. It's interviews between the clients themselves and Ross, who's the psychologist, and you just get a really deep glimpse into these people's lives, really interesting lives, but also a really interesting picture of the struggles they've had across their lives with mental health conditions and also with their own fears of death. So that's the majority of the book. And it really came about from our interest in fears of death, Ross and my interest in fears of death, and this realization that it seems to underlie a lot of mental health conditions. And we really wanted to, I guess, introduce that to the public in a way that really gave the clients and individuals themselves a chance to speak and have their voices heard, rather than it just being, you know, two academics writing about it. So really it was a way of trying to introduce this topic to people who might not be familiar with it, but who might be sharing some of these struggles themselves as well.
And that's the wonderful thing. I think that that's come across so beautifully with these 10 tales, because there's a little bit of intro to each of the individuals. Mm. They're male, they're female, they're young, they're old, they're remarkably normal in some ways, whatever normal is.
Yeah.
ordinary. And yet they've lived in some ways some really extraordinary experiences. So we get introduced to them, and then these interviews, you really do hear them in their own voice. They are just recounted, I'm guessing almost verbatim, perhaps with a bit of editorial work in there. So you really do get to hear from them in their voice as to their experiences, how they've grown up, their challenges that they've had in relation to, and these are largely anxiety disorders, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. It's mostly anxiety disorders and some cases of depression in there as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what I find amazing was that, and some of these stories, just to give you a little flavor, I don't want to spoil them because everybody needs to go and read it. As I said, it is just fascinating. But there's individuals who have struggled with fears of choking, for example. So some really underlying fears of choking on food, which has got to a point where this woman that I'm thinking of in particular would only eat, say, either in an emergency department or just outside of an emergency department of a hospital. So she'd actually got, you know, the fear that she was dealing with had become so disabling for her that is what life had become. And another individual who had essentially not left home really for 10 years because of the fears that he was dealing with and some of the behaviours that he was using to be able to cope with those fears. So these are obsessive compulsive disorder type behaviours, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think there are lots of cases in the book where you really get a glimpse into these people's lives and how much they've struggled with these fears. And yet, like you said, you know, they also seem in other areas they're functioning really well. You know, so the woman that you mentioned who was eating every meal in emergency departments for periods of her life, she was completely free from anxiety, but this sort of waxed and waned across her life. Something I really liked seeing in across the cases is the way that a lot of these individuals now are functioning remarkably well. They're studying, they're in relationships, and you get a sense of their kind of journey across their life and across treatment to get to this point where they're now able to put a lot of their fear behind them.
Yeah, they're actually really positive stories. And in fact, the tone of the book, despite being about death anxiety and case studies about people who have struggled with a number of different fears, which, and we'll go into this in a moment, you know, there's a kind of an underlying anxiety around death and some existential issues in there, which are fascinating in themselves. But despite that being the topic, essentially, they're actually very positive and uplifting stories in so many ways, aren't they, that these people have managed to work their way through with the assistance of the therapeutic relationship to a point where they are functioning mostly like the rest of us.
That's right. And I think it's a real testament to the work and kind of strides made in therapy on their part, because they're being asked often to do things that are very difficult and very confronting. But without those steps, there's very little room for improvement. And I think also hearing the stories told from their perspective also really gives this sense of hope and empowerment, because you get to hear them talk about the things they found most helpful, the things that give them meaning in life and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, and that is what makes it really real, isn't it? As you say, rather than having two academics speaking about these things at a conceptual level, although that in itself is really interesting, to bring it to life through the words of those who are living it. And the interview style, which I found really interesting, just having Ross there as the interviewer, capturing these case studies and being able to kind of, you know, follow down little paths and pull themes together and reflect back and paraphrase, I suppose, in the same way you might in a therapeutic setting.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. It's interesting as well to read some of the interviews that you can see, you feel like you're in the room there, and you can see at certain moments in the interviews, little snippets come out that even Ross wasn't aware of, really crucial parts sometimes in these people's lives that just never kind of came up in the 20, 30, 40 sessions of therapy, but are coming up suddenly in this interview for the book. So that was, I think, really interesting to see how sometimes really crucial bits of people's lives are just sort of swept under the rug, even in, you know, years of therapy.
Yeah, and perhaps it's only through that process, because my understanding is for these individuals, a large part, if not all of the work of therapy was kind of done for them, and that we're coming back and revisiting and reflecting in order to gather these interviews. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Mm. So perhaps it's even just that kind of the opportunity to reflect for both the therapist and the client and kind of review where they've come from and the progress that they've made, and that's had, you know, little snippets of new realizations in there too.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. I think there's a big sense of reflection, you know, across the cases of people looking back on their treatment or looking back on the struggles they were going through previously.
Mm. So Rachel, can you tell us a bit about, because we've used the term death anxiety, but I'm guessing it's actually a term that I wasn't even aware of as a psychologist until relatively recently. Can you tell us a little bit more about death anxiety? Because you research and write in the area. What is it?
Yeah, sure. So death anxiety is really, it's a common part of being human. It's this idea that we all have this inherent desire to live, to thrive, to survive. but we're also probably the only species that knows that death is inevitable. And so this pairing of wanting to live but also knowing that we can't do that forever can produce this anxiety in people. So death anxiety is something that most of us will experience, but in varying degrees. We might worry about different things. So I might worry about the death of my loved ones, whereas someone else might be more worried about their own death, dying in pain, dying of terminal illness, and so on. So it can sort of latch onto different things, but essentially it's just this fear of our own mortality or fear of impermanence more broadly.
And that tension too, that's what struck me as well, that tension between, you know, even for these people who are at times suicidal, you know, really feeling extreme pain and yet, you know, the fear of death plus the desire that we all have to survive, that kind of survival instinct thing creates this real, really interesting tension. I said interesting as an outsider looking in.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And I think, you know, for some of the individuals in the book, their lives that they're living are so unbearable, such difficult lives to live, and yet clearly there's still this striving to keep on fighting at any cost to prevent death.
Yeah, and that's where some of the ritualized type behavior comes in, isn't it? That it's there's these fears and the physical manifestation of anxiety that arises, you know, all of those almost crippling feelings, both physical and emotional, and that they then engage in behaviors that they feel at the time are helping to manage that anxiety. So it's kind of a short-term fix, but not a long-term fix. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, that's right. So it's those kind of behaviors are really people saying, you know, I'm not going to let death get me on my watch. So I'll wash my hands until they're red raw, but I'm not going to let any germs get onto me. Or I'll go to the hospital, you know, every second day because I'm not going to let a cardiac arrest get to me. So it's really people striving to fight off death at any cost, even if that's at a big detriment to their own quality of life.
Yeah. So things like, so that repeated, there was one individual who'd had, you know, so many ECGs and cardiac tests because there was a belief somewhere that his heart could just give out on him at any moment and therefore had, you know, a need to keep checking that over and over again, which, you know, I think we've probably all experienced snippets of those sorts of things, haven't we? You know, a fear of a particular illness or you know, it might be cancer, it might be a heart problem, it could be anything, and we all kind of fear that to a little degree. It's just for some people it obviously becomes a really dysfunctional thing.
That's right. And so, you know, on a spectrum, one end of the spectrum would be someone who is sort of so fearful of death they're avoiding any of those things, so maybe they're not going to the GP at all, even for recommended health checks, for example. At the other end is people who are doing that far too excessively. And then you're sort of aiming for that healthy balance in between where you're, you know, following doctors' recommendations, getting health checks when necessary, but it's not taking over your life the way it was for some individuals in the book.
So that's one example, but there's some other interesting and in some ways more extreme or less obvious perhaps examples of behaviors that people, these ritualized behaviors that people need to engage in order to reduce their anxiety. I'm thinking about the individual who couldn't ever travel from one location to another without coming back exactly the same way.
Yeah. Bharat was one individual in the book who, this was Bharat who you mentioned earlier, who basically didn't leave his house for 10 years, which is difficult enough in and of itself. But another one of his obsessions was about there being no lights or kind of electrical appliances on in the house. So essentially he lived in pitch black, no TV, no lights, nothing for a long time. And one of Bharat's other rituals were he had this belief, like you said, that he needed to always travel back identically the way he came. And he realized at one point he went on a trip somewhere and realized that for one reason or another, they couldn't drive back the same way. And this was something that terrified him. He had this belief that if he couldn't do that, something bad was going to happen. So he ends up riding on a bicycle backwards over the, I think it was the Harbour Tunnel or?
I think it was the Sydney Tunnel. Yeah, the Harbour Tunnel.
Yeah. Mm. Gets caught by police. The police have to escort him back because these obsessions had just reached such a point that he was really putting his life at risk riding backwards on a bicycle with incoming traffic. But it was the only way that he could have a sense of a safety and a sense that a kind of guarantee in his own mind of not dying.
Which is fascinating, the way the mind works, isn't it?
Yeah.
That we could get from an underlying fear of death that then kind of results in behaviours that in his case, you know, he was actually far more likely to die in those circumstances than he would just living a normal life, but his brain wasn't going to allow him to do that.
That's right. Absolutely. It's one of those kind of counterintuitive behaviors where you're putting yourself more at risk, but for whatever reason, it's giving you more of a sense of safety.
Mm, in that kind of immediate sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So interesting. We've talked a bit about the case studies that are in the book. And as I said, there's these 10 tales. And I even love the word tales because I think that does bring it to life. They're like little stories of people's experiences. And it's bookended, pardon the pun, with an introduction and then a kind of a conclusion summary on either end that I believe you wrote. Yeah. And part of that is just an introduction to humankind's thoughts and rituals and beliefs about death generally, you know.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? What are the kind of humankind's cultural and ritualistic responses to an underlying fear of death or that tension we talked about before?
Yeah. So in addition to my psychology background, my degree was also in ancient history. So I was always interested in looking at fears of death in the context of thousands of years of this experience. So you can see from at least 4,000 years ago, I mean, the first epic work of literature that we have centers on fears of death. So the Epic of Gilgamesh, which was a Babylonian poem, tells the story of a king who realizes he's going to die and goes on this lengthy quest to try and find the secret to immortality. So the oldest work we have is really all about fears of death. There's no other way to look at that story. So that would be an example. We can see things like the pyramids, for example, are clearly pharaohs trying to gain a sense of immortality, partly because they're tombs. That's literally what the pyramids were. But also they're clearly trying to build some kind of immortality on Earth, some kind of structure that's going to outlive them. So all of those kind of great works of architecture, great works of art, are attempts by the creators to try and live on after they die. Religion, of course, essentially every religion across the ages has offered some kind of solution to death, whether that's, you know, most commonly through a belief in the afterlife. So that would be one example. Literature, it's the really pervasive theme of literature. It's really a theme that kind of permeates every aspect of human culture across the last 4,000 years, which is, I think, why it was important to open with that information, because it's sort of showing that, you know, these 10 individuals aren't outliers. They might be suffering more than the ordinary person would be, but they're not the only ones who are talking about these issues and have experienced them. It's really such a central human struggle and has been for as long as we've been recording our history.
Yeah, and that's what I found kind of interesting was that context around it. Because again, you know, most of us, if we're living everyday life, we may have the odd thought of death or dying. And obviously that becomes more salient for some people, depending on what might be occurring in their life at the time. But it's not a big theme necessarily, certainly in everyday life. But when we start to ponder it, when you put it in that context of humankind, and particularly what interested me is some of those sort of, yeah, more existential issues, you know, for people, both our little tale protagonists, but also Gilgamesh and some of these bigger stories from history. And as you say, you know, artists and architects and people, you know, that desire to leave a mark on the world, to feel like we need some evidence that I was here and I mattered, maybe, which is obviously something that some people feel more acutely than others, perhaps. Would that be right?
Yeah, I think so. I think some people are more conscious of it than others. So some people, in fact, one of the individuals in the book, Aidan, talks about how his project of wanting to become a filmmaker, he admits, is his way of gaining some kind of immortality. But I think it's something we all do in really small ways. So Ernest Becker, who wrote The Denial of Death, which won him the Pulitzer Prize, he coined this term immortality projects. And he says that all of us are striving for some kind of immortality project in different ways. So maybe it's having children and investing a lot of time in children, for example. Maybe it's, you know, being an academic and publishing papers, or being a photographer and taking great photos that are going to hang on people's walls. So I think in a lot of ways, even if we're not conscious of it, a lot of our behavior seems to come back to what can I do to leave my mark on the world when I'm no longer here?
Yeah, which is really interesting, isn't it? Because as I said, I don't think I'd really given it much thought, but there were so many things in this book that prompted me to think about myself and my behavior, which is something that I'll get to in a moment as well. But yeah, you know, when I reflected on that for me personally, it was like, well, my children will live on and their children. Mm. I've always had an interest in genealogy and family history. So that connection of generations through time, you know, I'm just part of that puzzle, but because I have children now who will hopefully go on, they kind of continue it on. And while part of me thinks, oh, that's very self-important to think I need to leave a mark in the world, obviously it is. It's just part of being human.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the real pickup in genealogy in the last couple of years and in, you know, 23andMe and DNA and ancestry, I think that says a lot about how everyone, I mean, I'm the same. I'm really into genealogy. Everyone's sort of striving to get this sense of connection across time and the sense that I don't end at my death. I'll continue on through the next few generations. So I think all of those sorts of things are adaptive, helpful ways of coping with this fear, you know, tracing your lineage, being interested in family history, you know, taking vitamin supplements, all of those kinds of things are helpful ways of coping with the fear. But then, of course, in the book, we see those less helpful, more interfering ways of coping with the very same fear.
And I think that's a really important point. I think that phrase of helpful adaptive responses. So if these are all fears that we have as human beings kind of underlie somewhere in our core, whether we're particularly conscious of it or not, there are things that we can do that help us to adapt and cope with those things. And clearly for some people, for reasons of family history, one of the things that interested me was the number of people. So Ross in the questions asks people about their parents' experience of trauma, for example, or of deaths that may have had an impact on them. So this clearly plays a part in what happens across those generations as well. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So we know, for example, that, you know, there's a huge genetic or family history factor when it comes to anxiety disorders, but also things like early life experiences. So you mentioned losses. A lot of the individuals, I think 9 out of 10 of the 10 cases had some kind of early confrontation with death in some form or another, whether that was the death of a pet, the death of a grandfather, and other kind of general early life experiences. So we know that kids who are bullied, for example, have a 6-fold increase in the risk of having an anxiety disorder. So there's less research specifically on what leads to fears of death because it's quite a new area of research. But anxiety in general, of course, we know family history plays a big role. Early childhood experiences play a big role. And you see that play out for a lot of the individuals in the book.
Yeah, and coming back to that adaptive point, because one of the things that struck me, I was reading the case of, and I'm trying to remember her name, but she was a young girl.
Rose, maybe?
Rose, that was it, yeah. Rose. So Rose's story starts when she's only around 12, so she's entering therapy around the age of 12. Mm. And some of the things that she experienced, I mean, some of the fears seemed almost outlandish. You know, she had a belief somewhere that her mattress on her bed was filled with corpses and she was lying on corpses. So that, you know, that was like, oh my God, what a terrifying even thought to have as an adult, let alone as a child, but her brain had kind of conjured this up. Mm. But some of the others were things that I think a lot of us have experienced. You know, she'd seen taillights on cars through the window of her home and for some reason that had triggered a fear of, I can't remember if it was intruders, but it was just associated with a kind of a level of anxiety. And I know for me, with the current bushfires that are happening in New South Wales and in Queensland, I was around the age of 10 when Ash Wednesday occurred in Victoria, which is where I am. Mm. And I remember my parents were out for the night. We had a young babysitter and I remember, you know, the sky turned orange. We weren't even close. We were in, you know, central Melbourne, but it was such a significant event that it had an impact across the whole state. And the sky turned orange and there was ash falling in our front yard. And I remember feeling not necessarily terrified for myself. I felt very responsible for my younger sister because our parents weren't there. It was just the two of us.
Oh God.
And it was, you know, quite a, it was an upsetting evening, but I kind of held it all together because I had to be, you know, what I thought to be the grown-up older sibling. But one of the things that I remember was going to bed that night and in my bedroom as I lay there, there was a blind on a window and there was a doorknob. It was actually a window inside a door, so
there was a doorknob there, and the blind was kind of on the outside of the doorknob. So there was a gap and I could see this orange sky quite clearly. It was summertime, so it was still daylight savings. And from that night, I think every single night I stayed in that house for another probably 14 or 15 years, I had to pull that blind behind the doorknob so that there wasn't a gap and I couldn't see through that.
Yeah,
window.
Wow. Yeah, it would have been terrifying.
Well, it was just one of those funny, because it resulted in this behaviour. So this is kind of a little glimpse into how these sorts of things form. Now, all I had to do was close the blind and I was fine. So I'm assuming that that fits on the adaptive help end of the scale. But it was something that I had, it was like a compulsion. I had to do it. I was not going to be able to go to sleep in that room unless that blind was tucked behind that doorknob and I couldn't see that gap from that one experience. And it was just reflecting on that and then reflecting on a few other things. I suddenly went, oh yeah, I used to do, you know, kind of little weird stuff that I would worry about, and then little rituals I had to do, you know, make sure doors were closed and make sure. So these are behaviors that perhaps, or maybe it's not, maybe it's just me.
No,
I'm assuming. Yeah. I'm assuming that lots of people
does that, right? No, I think that's right. I think everyone could think of moments like that from, particularly from childhood, of the kind of irrational things you do to feel safe, you know. So I know I was terrified of the dark as a child and I did all kinds of things because of that fear. And I think everyone has experiences like that where even as an adult you might find you're checking the lock on your front door, for example, maybe a little more than you should. So it might not be on the OCD end of the spectrum, but maybe you're just a little more anxious about that sort of thing than other people would be. So I think all of us, the case is, even though there's such unusual stories, we can all kind of relate to small moments in them, which again shows that this is not an unusual, outlandish fear. It's so natural and something that everyone has some experience of feeling.
Yeah, especially those childhood stories. I think perhaps as children it's much harder to rationalize or even to understand things that are occurring in your life. You know, if you hear, or, you know, understanding a parent's behavior, for example, or the behavior of the adults around you. So that was one of the other stories, I think, of Mary, who had grown up in an environment where the surrounding adults all had significant fears for very good reasons, but those things probably didn't make a lot of sense to her. So what she internalized perhaps was just a general anxiety about the world.
Yeah, Mary's a really interesting case. So she's the first case in the book for a lot of reasons, but she was of Indigenous background and her family were of the Stolen Generation. So she grew up in this household where anytime there was a knock on the door, she was sort of shuffled away into a cupboard because her family was so worried that it was someone coming to take her away. So growing up in that kind of environment where you're getting all of these messages from your caregivers that the world is dangerous, that you're not safe, that people could just drop dead or take you at any moment, it makes sense that she goes on to develop this really crippling fear. And there are a couple of other cases like that across the book where parenting was either sort of too protective, it was anxious parents kind of sheltering their child in some ways, or on the other hand, parenting that was so hands-off that the child goes on to become quite anxious because they don't develop this sense that other people are around them to protect them and take care of them. So lots of really interesting examples, I think, of how we can almost kind of inherit trauma from parents, particularly in the case of the Stolen Generation and Indigenous history, I think.
Yeah, that was a really interesting point of context for me. I think that really brought it home that if you have grown up in an environment where people are just, kids are just taken away and for not obvious or good reasons at all, you know, how that fear could then perpetuate throughout generations and lead to significant issues, you know, intergenerationally, if that's a word.
Definitely.
Incredible. Rachel, what's the science? So part of the premise of this book is that we have this underlying death anxiety, but also that it can then manifest in a range of mental health disorders for individuals. What does the science tell us about that side of things?
It's a really new area of research. So it's only really been strongly driven in the last couple of years. So over the last few decades, there have been sort of correlational studies here and there showing relationships between fears of death and different disorders. But in the last few years, for example, my research has looked at, again, correlations, so showing huge relationships between death anxiety and the number of medications people are on for mental health, the number of times they've been hospitalized, the number of diagnoses they'll have across their lifespan. So one thing we know is that people typically accrue diagnoses across their lifespan. So if I'm presenting for treatment now with two diagnoses, it's likely that across my life I'll end up having a total of 4 diagnoses. So this raises the question of, you know, what's going on that people are receiving treatment for one disorder, but they're coming back a few years later with a different disorder. So my research has sort of suggested that fears of death might be underlying this, because we know that the higher someone's fear of death is, the greater number of diagnoses they'll have across their lifespan. And these effects remain significant when you take into account neuroticism and so on. So that's the kind of correlational research. But I've also done some experimental research looking at how reminders of death seem to impact relevant behaviors. So for example, in OCD, we know that reminders of death led people to spend twice as long washing their hands compared to people in a control condition. I'm doing a study at the moment looking at sort of body checking behaviors. So people who are checking their body for signs of illness. And we know that reminders of death lead people with those kinds of disorders. So panic disorder, illness, anxiety, reminders of death lead those individuals to spend much more time checking their body, to say that they're going to go to their GP more frequently, and also to view their own body as more dangerous than people who haven't been reminded of death. So over the last couple of years, there's a really growing area of literature showing that reminders of death impact a whole range of clinically relevant behaviors, and fears of death also seem to be strongly implicated in the number of diagnoses, people's ratings of their distress, how severe their symptoms are, and so on. So it's a really new area of research, but so far we're seeing really, really strong results, results that are quite uncommon to get in the social sciences. The effect sizes are really large. And I think it's a pretty clear indication that death anxiety is having some role in these mental health problems.
Okay, so it's at that early stage, and from the sounds of things, very exciting stage of being able to say there are clear patterns here. We're seeing patterns. Perhaps this is something we really need to delve into further to do that further research to understand, you know, what perhaps is some of the causality in there. And then what's the goal? Is the goal then to be able to obviously to, you know, use this to inform treatment? Is that the idea?
Absolutely. So the idea is that if death anxiety is underlying these conditions, then the standard treatments we would usually do for them, if they're not addressing the fear of death, then this might explain that revolving door where people kind of cycle in and out of mental health services. So my goal has really always been to try and develop more effective treatments to specifically target these fears. So at the moment, I'm about to start a clinical trial for an online treatment, a CBT, so cognitive behavior therapy-based treatment of fears of death. And hopefully, if we're specifically targeting that worm at the core, we would expect that people would see general improvement in their mental health.
Which is very exciting stuff. I mean, it's really, if what you suggest the research is indicating is that, you know, this might be the kind of, or at least one of the factors that if we can address it early, then we may actually be able to deal far more effectively with some of these really tricky and resistant ongoing mental illnesses over time.
Yeah, absolutely. So already there's a huge interest in transdiagnostic treatments. So things like perfectionism, rumination, low self-esteem, those sorts of transdiagnostic constructs get a lot of attention, and there are a lot of new treatments trying to target those processes for the same sort of reason, because it's more accessible and easier than trying to just treat the disorder that someone's presenting with then and there. And interestingly, in some areas, death anxiety seems to play a much bigger role than these well-established transdiagnostic processes. So one study, for example, not one of my studies, but one study found that death anxiety predicted more of eating disorder symptoms than something like perfectionism, which we see as a very established factor in eating disorders. The correlations that I found between death anxiety and mental health problems are often as strong as, and often stronger than, things like self-esteem, rumination, and perfectionism. So I think it's a new area of research, but I think it, in my view, at least from my research, it seems to be playing as big a role, if not bigger, than some of these established transdiagnostic constructs.
Yeah, so as you say, the worm at the core of these things, so really being able to get to kind of the heart of the issue so that we're addressing that rather than perhaps some of the symptoms or, the behaviours that are kind of resulting, which
that's
will
right.
hopefully help to, really it's a bigger lever, isn't it, to have a bigger effect.
Yeah, that's exactly right. If I'm currently worried about germs, if that fear of germs gets treated, if I learn a lot about the immune system and how effective that is, it makes sense that if I'm still fearful of death, yes, my fear of germs has been cured, but maybe now I'm going to fear spiders instead, for example. So if that fear isn't treated, it makes sense that the focus of my fear is going to keep shifting because that underlying cause hasn't been addressed.
It's just going to keep popping up just in different ways.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very interesting. What sort of time frame do you think it's going to take till we know more? Obviously, you're working very hard on it, but
I'm working very hard. I don't know. I think it's become a much more popular topic in the last few years, and I think a lot of people are now becoming very interested in it. So I think, I know, for example, there are a couple of students at Sydney Uni working on this. So Matteo Zaccala, actually, we just had a paper accepted today on death anxiety.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I know there's a number of researchers looking at this at UTS in Sydney. So I think in the next few years, we're going to have a kind of flooding of research on this topic, which is really great because we've had such a lack of it for the last couple of decades.
Mm. And it's one of the reasons because, I mean, this you talk about existential dilemmas in the book, and we've kind of touched on this already, but conceptually difficult stuff. I'm really fascinated that you've been able to put in some experimental design around this in order to be able to capture things that are really hard to define, I'm guessing. How do you define an existential dilemma, for example?
It is a sort of broad concept. Really, it's anything where, I mean, the existential philosophers would say it's when there's some kind of conflict. So we mentioned the conflict between striving to live but knowing we're going to die. They talk a lot about meaninglessness. So as a species, we're a species that really wants a sense of purpose and meaning, but we've kind of been thrust onto this rock hurtling through space where there's no inherent meaning to anything in our environment. They also talk about the idea of isolation. So as a species, we crave social contact and social relationships, but we can only ever see the world through our one set of eyes. So I can never truly get into the head of my partner or my closest friend. So these are the sorts of existential issues that these philosophers are referring to. And you can see how clinically they would be very relevant. So meaninglessness is, of course, something people talk about a lot. Same goes for isolation. So they're these really human experiences that are seen as the kind of inescapable facts of being human. So I can never escape the fact that I can only ever see my world through my own set of eyes and not through the eyes of my partner, for instance.
Mm. And that's how you wrap the book up, isn't it? In a final chapter that looks at some of these existential issues and what the philosophers or the constructs that they've created to be able to help us to understand some of this stuff. The meaning and meaninglessness, which again is a theme that comes through in the stories from our individuals. And that fascinates me because I work in the field of positive psychology. So we're looking at meaning and purpose is really coming through as one of the strong themes in what contributes to a thriving, flourishing life. So it's almost like kind of looking at it from the other end of that spectrum, you know, not having it is leading perhaps to levels of anxiety and distress. The goal is to create more of it to be able to thrive, and probably most of us somewhere in the middle on that spectrum. What's your take on that sense of meaning and purpose? What do our protagonists tell us in the stories about meaninglessness?
Yeah, so a lot of the individuals in the stories talk a lot about how finding meaning was crucial for them. So Mary is probably one of the best examples of this. It was Mary who we've talked about with the Indigenous background and who was eating every meal in emergency departments. She talked about how when she was a teenager, she had 2 years where she was completely symptom-free, where every single one of her fears went away. And the only change at this point in her life is that she had a job for the first time. It wasn't a particularly sort of high rank job. She was working in fast food, but for the first time, she had this sense of purpose and this sense of independence. And for that entire time, all of her symptoms went out the window. So she was a really striking example of the importance of purpose. And a lot of them talk about purpose in different ways. So Rose, who feared that her mattress was full of corpses, for example, I particularly liked her case. She talks now about how she's working, I think, as a volunteer at a veterinary clinic, and she's caring for the animals there, and that gives her a sense of purpose, which she's found really helpful. So I think meaning can be one of these things that can really help allay some of these concerns for people, that if we can find some kind of purpose, if we can feel like we're giving back, for example, that seems to be something that's quite powerful in getting rid of these fears.
And I think that's what's so striking about those stories is that they're examples of, you know, when we think, especially if we're sort of thinking in these kind of broader philosophical terms about meaning and purpose, we think about it as being some kind of grand experience that we have to have, that we need to seek and pursue throughout our lifetime. But in fact, these are very practical and in some ways quite day-to-day experiences of volunteering or of having a job for the first time. So that idea that meaning and purpose, and one of the definitions that I love most that I use with groups that I work with is just this idea of, you know, serving something that's bigger than yourself.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So thinking about, you know, what are things that I value and how can I actually live those out, those values out day to day? You know, you're right. It doesn't have to be, you don't have to start some revolution. It's really just about doing something that gives you a sense that you're giving back to people and doing something that gives you a sense of meaning. And I think what's important there as well is, you know, what do you actually value? So it doesn't have to be something that your friends or family consider meaningful. If your idea of meaningful is volunteering in your community garden, that's meaningful. You know, that's something that's going to be helpful to you.
Yeah. And I think I like, that's why I like that kind of doing something that serves something bigger than yourself, because I know when I talk to groups, sometimes it's the example of, you know, I volunteer at the local footy club. I just love being there every weekend. Yeah. I love being part of something bigger. You know, I love the teams. I might be helping with rosters or canteen or whatever it might be, but it's that sense that I'm here, I'm useful, I'm part of a bigger community, and helping people, as you say, to tap into that stuff that's meaningful for them. So there isn't kind of, you know, meaning and purpose is not a big thing that we all have to go find. We're probably doing it. It's just noticing to some extent sometimes.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You know, just looking at what we already do and thinking about and perhaps doing more of the stuff that gives us that little sense of meaning and helping others, or, you know, fulfilling some kind of purpose.
Definitely.
And so fascinating that, as you say, for some of the stories that we're looking at in the book, that they are perhaps not entirely symptom-free like Mary, but, you know, there's, when they start to feel that they're doing something, they're also starting to feel better.
Absolutely, yeah. So for some of them, it was through, you know, environmental activism. For others, it was through, you know, creating films or creating some kind of artwork. Photography is another one that comes up in the book. And that seems to be something that a lot of them talk about as being most useful to them in their treatment.
Mm. And connection and relationships was another one, wasn't it? You talked before about that sense of isolation, and that was something that really got me thinking too about that experience of really, essentially, we are all on our own, which does sound a bit terrifying when you think about it. You know, we come into the world on our own, we leave the world, you know, perhaps not literally on our own, but it is a personal journey that we go through, and everything we experience in life can only really be seen through the lens of our own personal journey, which if you do get, I could kind of, you know, when I started thinking about that, I could see where that fear could start to spiral out of control if we got a little preoccupied with it.
Yeah, definitely. You don't want to focus on that one for too long.
No.
Maybe you do.
I don't know, but I could see where it could become problematic for people. So for some of the stories, again, it was about then having a sense of connection to somebody, having a relationship with somebody that was important, that made them feel slightly less alone, or at least focus maybe less on that aloneness.
Yeah, definitely. So Matilda is a perfect example of that in the book. Her chapter's called All You Need Is Love, because that's really what her story, I think, is communicating. She was crippled with all kinds of fears, so fears of illness. Every time she would go on public transport, she would worry that it might explode. She wouldn't use stoves. She worried stoves might explode. She worried not only that she might murder someone, but that she might also be framed for the murder of someone. So her fears really riddled every area of her life. But then interestingly, as soon as she finds her first partner, again, her fears really completely go away. And that's really why her case made the book, because she was such an amazing example of the transformative power of relationships. But as soon as she finds her first meaningful, stable relationship, all of her fears go away. And relationships are one of these things that we also know there's quite good evidence for, that relationships seem to buffer fears of death, that relationships can kind of keep us safe from those existential concerns. And she's just such an amazing example of that.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, the thought that went through my mind at that point, because my first instinct was, but we can't control what other people do. What if they leave? What if they, you know, and then we're on our own, and do all the symptoms come back again? But I suppose the broader point is that we can foster a number or a range of different relationships. And we do hopefully all have a number of range of different relationships in our lives. And that might be enough of a buffer.
Definitely, definitely. So even if it's not a kind of romantic, intimate relationship, those connections with other people seem quite powerful. We know, for example, that when you remind people of death, they show all of these behaviors suggesting they're seeking relationships. So if you give people a death reminder, for example, they sit closer next to strangers in a group discussion, for instance, or they report greater commitment, greater attraction to their current partner. So death seems to kind of drive us to connect with other people, whether that's a partner, whether that's even just strangers in a group discussion. Mm. So relationships in any form seem really transformative.
Mm. And so fascinating, because that comes through so strongly in the happiness research as well, in the positive psychology research, that both that sense of meaning and purpose, but also that connection and relationships are so fundamental to us being able to kind of thrive and survive and flourish in our lives. So again, you know, same concept, different ends of the construct. Rachel, I just want to ask you really quickly, because one of the things that comes through in the stories is a little around the treatment, and it's not something that any of the stories focus on in any significant way, but it's mentioned, and that is this idea of exposure treatment, I suppose, or exposure as a form of treatment for a lot of people in these spheres. Can you just really briefly tell us a little bit about how that works?
Yeah, of course. So at the moment, exposure therapy is the only treatment that we have good evidence for in helping fears of death. And really, exposure just involves gradually, step by step, exposing the individual to their fear. So, for example, if I have a fear of dying of a terminal illness, it might be getting me to write down a detailed story of imagining myself diagnosed with the illness. And then maybe I read it over and over again until my anxiety comes down. It might be getting me to picture my own funeral, for example, or make funeral arrangements or write a will. So the idea with exposure in general is really about facing and confronting the fear rather than avoiding it. So we typically have this urge to avoid things that give us anxiety. But if there's no actual threat, if the anxiety is unfounded, then we want to actually face the fear. So in the context of fears of death, this is really getting people just closer to confronting death. So maybe it's watching movies with themes of death, reading a book with a character who's dying, anything that gets people actually thinking about and talking about death rather than avoiding it.
Hmm. So it seems counterintuitive in that. And I suppose it's the same, you know, when people who use exposure therapy for fear of spiders or fear of flying or those sorts of things, it's the same process, isn't it?
That's
just
right.
A gradual exposure to the thing that's creating the anxiety. It just seems more extreme when your fear is death, and that we then ask people to really confront death, because it's a confronting thing for the majority of us to have to deal with. For somebody who, you know, has experienced such significant levels of anxiety around it, it just feels even bigger.
Yeah, I think it is a confronting thing for everyone to think about. But I do think part of that is because we don't talk about it and we avoid thinking about it. So, of course, if I avoid thinking about my own funeral, for example, it makes sense that when it does cross my mind, it's going to give me a bit of panic. Whereas if I'm thinking about this every day, that panic is not going to stick around for very long. So the idea is, if we can face the fear rather than avoiding it, it's going to reduce the anxiety. And I think it's probably also going to change the way we think about death. So it's probably also going to challenge some of our beliefs about, you know, how we might cope with the death of a loved one, for example, if we're actually thinking about it more often than we would otherwise if we're avoiding it.
Mm, and that's such a lovely point, because I know there is a push more generally in our community to start thinking and talking about death as part of life, as being, which it is, you know, a very normal experience, and being able to normalize it. I was speaking to somebody locally who's training as a death doula. Mm. So somebody who actually, like a birth doula, is there to support loved ones, families, and the individual themselves through a death. So the fact that there's that in existence, there's a wonderful book and the name escapes me at the moment. It's The Bottom Drawer, something like that. I'll find it and put it in the show notes. But again, it's designed to start conversations about death and dying. So yeah, maybe for all of us, there is a benefit to just a little bit more exposure in order to reduce a bit of general anxiety.
Yeah, absolutely. I think thinking about death really changes your perspective on a lot of things in life. And I've been personally thrilled to see in the last few years this real upsurge in the death positivity movement and lots of books coming out on the subject, which I think is a really good sign that kind of society, I guess, is moving in the right direction and talking about this thing that happens to all of us, rather than sort of pretending that if we don't talk about it, it's somehow not going to happen. So I think it's a great time at the moment, particularly for this kind of work, in that there's a lot of resources out there to get clients reading. So it's the perfect time for these kind of things to come out in terms of homework for exposure tasks and that kind of thing, getting people to read a lot of these amazing books that are out at the moment on death. Because again, you know, keeping it in silence doesn't really do anyone any favors, I think.
Yeah, So, Rachel, I'm going to close by asking you, because you're clearly immersed in this every day, you know, what has this immersion in the topic of death done for you? What have you learned, or how do you feel that it's been beneficial to you?
Yeah, I think it's been incredibly valuable for me. I think I, like a lot of people, had a lot of fears of death. And I think it's hard for those fears to stick around when you're living and breathing it every day. I think also doing this sort of work, it forces you to question your own assumptions about death. So assumptions like death is inherently bad, or death will be painful, or I couldn't cope if a loved one died. Because you're sort of having to prepare yourself to challenge these beliefs in clients when they come up, it sort of forces you to question your own assumptions about it as well. So I think the more I at least have been thinking about death, it's definitely changed my appreciation of life, my perspective on life, and definitely reduced some of my own fears as well.
So you're far more at peace with the prospect.
Yeah, it's hard not to be when you're doing it every day. You'd hope by now I'd be at peace, or else I'd be in a bit of trouble.
Yeah.
Far more at peace, I think.
Rachel, thank you so much. I've thoroughly enjoyed this, and there's so many more questions I could ask you, but I don't want to keep you any longer. We'll put all of the details for, you know, the research, your research, other resources that we've mentioned over the course of this discussion in the show notes for this episode. And of course, I absolutely encourage everybody to get hold of a copy of Tales from the Valley of Death, Reflections from Psychotherapy on the Fear of Death. It's published by Australian Academic Press, and it's out now.
Yes, out now.
Wonderful. Again, I'll put a link so that people can find out where and how to get hold of their copy and read it. I think if for no other, well, aside from the fact that it's filled with just the most captivating stories and exceedingly easy to read, it, I think, perhaps does go a little to that conversation we were just having about perhaps all exposing ourselves a little bit more to the prospect of death, the conversations around death and thoughts of both death and our existence, and therefore perhaps helping us all to be like you and a little more at peace.
Yeah, thank you. We're honestly so proud of this book, and we really do think it can help a lot of people.
I think it will. I'm quite sure it will. It's just wonderful. Congratulations, Rachel, and also to Ross on the book and all the work that you're doing. I'm going to follow with interest your continued research so that I can keep learning as you keep discovering. And thank you again for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
How fascinating was that? Tales from the Valley of Death is published by Australian Academic Press. It's now available both online and in bookstores in hard copy. And I've popped a link in the show notes if you'd like to get yourself a copy, which I highly recommend that you do. And of course, if you'd like to find out more about Rachel, her research, her writing and her work, as well as some of the other resources that we mentioned in this episode, you'll find all the links, as always, that you need in the show notes for this episode. So pop over to potential.com.au/podcast, and there's a transcript of the episode available there too. Now, a quick thank you to the Wellbeing Evidence and Horizons Conference for partnering with us to bring you this episode of the show. The conference is being held on the 28th and 29th of April 2020 in Melbourne, Australia. If you'd like to find out more about the conference and register to attend, because early bird pricing is available for another couple of months yet, you can do so at weh.org.au, and there's a link in the show notes to that too. And now I have a quick question for you. Have you joined the Potential Psychology Podcast Facebook group? I have included a link to the group in the show notes if you haven't, but you're keen to. The Facebook group is where we can chat a bit about the topics covered in each episode. You can ask questions of me or of our guests. I'll share a bit of behind the scenes stuff, just mostly just pictures of my setup because there's really not that much to see. Although I did share a picture of me doing some work to prep a recent episode on a bus at 9:30 at night. So it gives you a little insight into the high glamour world of the podcaster. There's a series of videos at the moment that I'm including in the group. So there's one a week for 12 weeks. And these are from the world's leading lights in positive psychologists. So our, you know, superstar researchers and practitioners talking about a range of topics, everything from parenting to workplace wellbeing, to resilience, to positive education, to post-traumatic growth. And that's just a sample of it. So there's one a week in the group for the next 12 weeks. I'm also adding links to books and articles tools, because I know that you love to learn. And it's really anything and everything that you want it to be, because it is a community space. That's what I've established it for. So to find us, just follow the link in the show notes or search the Potential Psychology Podcast on Facebook. The group should pop up, send a request to join, and I'll add you in. It will be lovely to have you there. Okay, so next week, there's no guest next week. It's just me. I had a lot of people let me know that you enjoyed my solo episode last season, which was on motivation and why everything we know about motivation is wrong. And there's an online program in the works for 2020 on that very topic as well. So I thought I'd push outside my comfort zone before we hit the end of this season and the end of the year and record another solo episode. And that's what's coming up next week. And the topic is procrastination. So another one of my favorite topics. Why, when you think you're procrastinating, you're probably not. And most importantly, what does the research tell us about what we can do to stop it? So that's next week on the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'd better get recording. I can't wait to share it with you. But in the meantime, as always, stay safe, go forth and fly. Thrive and flourish and fulfill your potential.